This is FM 2.0 with the Don, Dean, Stormy, and the Grizz. Forever music.
Been here. This is our first time trying this with Dean's setup.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to FM 2.0 Forever Music. Dean's clicking on something right now to see if it works. We've got Joe Vitale here. Joe, great to have you. So great to have you.
Definitely an honor.
Yes.
Oh, is he locked up?
Uh-oh. Is Joe frozen? Oh, nope. There you are.
We have rotten weather here, so the internet might flicker a little.
Well, you know what? We've dealt with all kinds of things. We can.
Yeah, but it comes right back. If I go away, I come right back.
There you go. It sounds like a song.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll go away and I'll come right back.
We'll play one. We'll write one.
Yes.
Yeah. Collab. So wait.
Dean, let us know when you think you got it working.
Hey, it looks like it's about to work.
Yay. Boy, we're gonna a big expanded audience tonight. You got to love it. We're just waiting here. Click, 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 click. So, Joe, when I go back through all the stuff you've been a part of, I'm just going to start it off right off the bat here. One of the greatest, there's songs, and I'm sure you've had them in your life, the songs that when you hear them, you can't help but get very emotional about it. The Beach Boys with God Only Knows hits me every time I hear it. But the fact that you co-wrote Pretty Maids All in a Row.
Right.
Like, I was listening to it today again. When I've listened to it, and again, I get tears in my eyes. There's something about that song. And the way Joe sings it.
Yeah, the whole production gets you. It's really, really well done.
Yeah.
Can you just tantalize me on the writing of that song? Like, just because it's such a special song and it hits me every time like a ton of bricks. Can you talk about writing that song?
Yeah. The way me and Joe Walsh always worked and still work is he'll call me and say, hey, I got this idea, or you know, or I'm hanging out with him and he'll sit at the piano and go, hey, listen to this. What do you think of this? And he goes, can you help me finish it? He says, I'm kind of stuck. I don't know where to go. We've done this so many times. And same with Pretty Maids All in a Row. Of course, we didn't have a title yet. He didn't have a title for it yet, but he had these verses, and the verses were just beautiful. And that's all he had at the time were these verses. But when you co-write with people.
Uh-oh, the weather.
Pass the creation to somebody because they hear where you're at. And people get stuck writing songs and they're kind of a dead end, you know. And I don't know what it is about that. I do the same thing. I reach out to people to help me in the same fashion. And Joe called me and said, I got this. He played me the verse. It's beautiful, Joe. And I said, let me sit with it for a second. And the best way for me to co-write is I got to learn what he did first. So I sit down and play what he did. So I get that in my head and my hands, and I'm feeling that, right? And then I said, I know where to go. And the first time I did that, he said, oh, that's good. Keep going. So what I did was I wrote the pre and chorus and the chorus to it. And he had the verses and he didn't know where to go with it. And it's not that, and Joe's a terrific writer. He might have ended up going somewhere or somewhere different, all that, but it doesn't matter. It's in the history books now. We wrote the way we wrote it is the way we wrote it. And so that's the way we've always done things. Everybody that co-writes does things differently, you know, but that's how he does it. You know, he says, here's what I got. What would you do with this? And that's really a great way to co-write with people, because it gives them a whole opportunity to take it from where they left off, you know. And so that's what happened there. And so I wrote the chorus, and then we could immediately hear Eagles harmonies, and we could hear the whole thing. And it was like, all right, we knew we had something. We didn't know how it was going to turn out, really, because until you record it, but we knew that there was something there. And obviously Don Henley and Glenn Frey knew that they liked what they heard, and they just did an amazing job on it.
Now at that time, I mean, the Eagles were big, but they weren't at that astronomical point yet, were they? I mean, that was
I didn't know Joe. I didn't know that we were writing a song for Hotel California, because that concept hadn't even been there yet. It wasn't even started. They didn't even start there. They were just gathering songs. So, you know, Hotel California is probably their biggest record, of course. But so at that point, they're a big band, but they didn't go to mega stars until, I would say, till after that for Hotel California. But so we didn't really know that we were writing for such a, now we just were writing a song, and he was going to give it to the Eagles, and it happened to go on like their biggest record. But you know, that that's not the why you write a, you write a song from your heart and from your soul, and you know,
he locked up a bit.
I didn't know it. I knew it was going to an Eagles record, but I didn't know how big that record was going to be.
Wow. Now, what's interesting, like, I've always thought of you as drums, but you play a lot of instruments. And
yeah, it's called job security.
Well, for example, your flute playing is...
I was going to ask the same thing about his flute playing.
So what order did you learn your instruments?
I started as a drummer. Okay. But my father and... There he is. Oh, wait a minute. I'm backwards. There's my dad with his accordion.
An accordion?
Yeah, that's it. That's him with the accordion. And my dad loved the idea that I started playing drums, but he says, you can play the drums. That's great. But you must learn keys. You have to learn the piano and the concept and the theory of piano. He says, you don't have to be a piano player, but you have to learn. And he was right, because... It through all the years, I mean, that's how I write, with a piano, you know, and I always say that, you know, Wipeout was already written, so there's no other drum songs.
So when I talked to
Let Ken There Aronoff, Be Drums, right?
Right, right.
So I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Kenny Aronoff. So he started off studying marimba, or I don't know if he started, he spent time studying marimba. And yeah. So since you play piano, you have that knowledge of melody, of harmony. Do you feel like that gives you a different advantage as a drummer?
It certainly does, because you have that knowledge helps you in all areas. You know, when we're recording and somebody says, we need to go to the bridge and let's go to a minor, or let's go to a four or a five chord, or you kind of know what they're talking about, and it's kind of helpful. And also, if they're asking for suggestions in the studio, or if anybody got any ideas of where should we go, you know, to have that knowledge is really helpful, that you can actually sit down at a piano. You don't have to be a great piano player or even a guitar player if you're a drummer, you know, but you have enough knowledge to go, hey, what about this? And you try this and you can play the piano and all. So it's been an advantage, 100%, all the time it helps. And, the stuff I wrote with Graham Nash for Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young stuff, same thing. I mean, he's a guitar player. I would sit at my piano and he would have his guitar and we would, you know, write and compose and stuff. And so I would highly recommend any musician that wants to learn a second or third instrument, whatever. That's such a good idea, because you don't have to be a player on those, but you get an insight on what that instrument is able to do and what its job is and all that. And so God bless my father for doing that, because I would have never picked up. I would have never sat at the piano and learned piano. I wanted to be a drummer, but he insisted. So I, you know, and he was dad. So. So I did, and there's not a day that goes by that I don't thank him, you know.
How good did you get on the accordion?
Oh, I didn't play the accordion.
No polka? There's not going to be a polka album coming out?
No, no more polkas. I played in his polka band when I was like 13, 14. And so, no, I didn't want to play the accordion, but we had.
That's great.
Yeah.
Really fun.
Yeah. Well, on Madman, you know, the when you go into the flute, you're rocking that thing.
Yeah, it's fun. I love the flute. When I saw, I listened to and heard Jethro Tull years ago, I said, man, that's such like a great sound. And I didn't expect to really learn how to play it as much as I just want. I picked up a flute at the music store, and I took a few lessons and just to kind of get started. And I just fool around with it. And it's not my instrument, but it's fun to play. And I wish I had more time to work on it, but that's what I liked about it. When I heard those Jethro Tull records, they were very cool with flute, you know, but rock and roll and flute didn't really make much sense, but it kind of worked for them.
Yeah, it works for you too. So then do you have an appreciation for concept albums? I guess when I listen to your solo works, it's not just your straight up pop. You've got some, you know, layers, you got some complexity in there. So were you like a fan of the later Beatles albums like Revolver and Sgt. Pepper?
Right. I was. And our dear friend Bill Simzik, who produced all the stuff we did, I produced Joe and my second solo record and all the Eagles stuff and Sager and on and on and on. He's produced everybody. He used to call albums back in the day, the 40 minute radio station. And because any record you'd put on, you'd get like, you know, who know, you could get a blues tune and then a ballad, then a heavy rock song, and then maybe even a reggae song or whatever. And so it was like a 40 minute radio station. What happened was, I used to really like that because, artists didn't drift too far from what their sound was, but they experimented and they tried different things. What happened was a lot of times is the record companies, they kind of got pissed. They said, hey, wait, you guys had a hit with, you know, with this big rock song. That's all we want to hear from you is rock. It's like, you kind of hurt the creativity, and there's nothing wrong with a band trying different things. I mean, you know, to an extent, you can't go a little too far outside of your realm. But he used to call it the 40-minute radio station. And if you listen to all the albums that Bill did, they're kind of like that. There's mm-hmm. different styles of music, and there's almost on some of Joe Walsh's records we did, there's like almost like some classical stuff, and then there's definitely some hard rock, some ballads. There's some 50s style doo wop kind of stuff, and I mean, it was fun to make those records, but the record companies got a little funny about it, and we didn't quite understand that because we said, hey, we're selling records for you. Why would you change anything, you know? But they said, no, that, you know, your fans want to hear a certain thing and stick with that. It's like, okay, whatever.
You know, it's funny.
It's like a double-edged sword, you know?
Yeah.
Because you piss off part of your fan base, but then you're bringing in new fans at the same time. So it's kind of like a
double-edged sword. You know, when you have fans that, you know, would buy your records and stuff like that, you know,
they're
like pretty, loyal fans. Right. And they may not like some of the stuff you did, but they're still fans. They'll buy that. You know, they would purchase your records and listen to what you got. And what was fun about that was when you take it to the stage and you play live, it was really fun in the middle, like, in the middle of a hard rock song, you do like a slow blues or a reggae tune or something like that. It's really fun, you know, but I guess that's not kosher anymore. I don't know. Joe Walsh does it. He doesn't care. He'll play whatever he wants to play, and God bless him, you know.
Don and I were talking about this yesterday. I shared Billy Corgan on Howard Stern had made the comment. He was talking about at their height. When you would think that everything they did was gold, he was talking about how frustrating it was because they had one song that the labels came back to and just said, start writing like this, only like this. And he talked about just how frustrating it was. And again, looking back at that time, you'd think, wow, everything they did was gold. He's got to be happy. And the reality is, it sounds like he was miserable at that time.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll tell you what the double-edged sword is the record, you know, your fans kind of criticize some of that sometimes because they go, hey, wait a minute, that sounds like that other song. And, you know, and it's like, you know, you're up against a wall sometimes with labels and that's just what they do. And they're in the business to sell records and they get a brand or a format, and that's what they want to do, you know, and they don't get it that, you know, if you have a big hit in a certain song, that doesn't guarantee you at all that you're going to have another hit of a similar sounding song. It's crazy, you know?
Yeah, yeah, they limit your creativity to put you in a box because they want to try to pump out more of that.
Yeah, look at the Beatles records. There's not two songs that sound alike in a Beatles record. And they've got hundreds and hundreds of songs, you know? And so that's my Bible. I look at what they did because they're, you know, and while they were the Beatles, their label didn't tell them what to do. They told the label what to
do. Hell, they had a couple of songs where they didn't even play any instruments on them. Eleanor Rigby.
I love them. they're my favorites. I watched them on Ed Sullivan in 1964 and February 9th and unbelievable. And I don't know if you guys saw that cartoon online about the old couple that walked past the record store, and there's an ad on the side of the store. It says Rolling Stones new album and the Beatles have a new single. And it was an ad because we turned the clocks back the other day. Right. And the guy goes, how far back did we turn the clocks?
Exactly.
It was pretty funny. Exactly. It was kind of like a cartoon. And I was hoping that we just did the Vets Aid show with Joe Walsh out in San Diego there. And I was hoping that Ringo would show up because he usually does when Joe plays pretty close to L.A. And I was going to tell him how funny I thought that was, but he was busy doing something else. So,
well, I wanted to ask. He's got his album out, his EP.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, you know, speaking of music, because, you know, the music nerd that I am, what was it like when you were in the studio or the first time you're in rehearsal and you heard Life's Been Good? Because that song, just as a kid growing up and I heard that song and the lyrics and the music, that was just such a different type of song that was radio. Like, it got played on the radio a lot and you couldn't even release that today because it's such a progressive type song. It's got chord changes and time changes and the lyrics are, you know, so wild. So what was that like when that song was presented and you heard it for the first time?
I didn't hear the song the first time, and I'll tell you why. That song, Life's Been Good, is a combination of four songs. Joe brought four ideas to the studio. Each one of them was going to be a song.
Wow.
The main da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was going to be kind of like a Rolling Stones kind of thing, you know. And then we had the reggae thing. He loves reggae. Joe loves reggae. So dun 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 dun. And then we had the sequencer part. We got the jazz. Anyway, Joe brought these little riffs in, and we recorded four different songs. And they weren't songs yet. They were just the tracks, right? And we left it at that because he didn't have any lyrics. We had no titles. We had nothing. We just had these riffs that he was playing, and we'd play them for like 10 minutes, you know, each one. Anyway, it was Friday afternoon. We go home, and Monday morning, Bill Simzik, we get to the studio, and Bill Simzik, what a genius. He says, sit your butts down. And he turns it really loud and he hits play. And it was Life's Been Good. He had edited all those pieces together to make one song. And it sounded like we actually recorded it like that. But I don't know if anybody knows about that. It's no secret. It's been out. Joe's talked about it. Everybody, you know, kind of know. But I mean, it's not not everybody knows about that. It was four different pieces that Bill edited together and made Life's Been Good. And we never recorded that song the way it sounds on the record. We didn't record it like that. We recorded it in four different pieces. And he, you know, back then, a 2-inch tape and razor blade, you know, he cut it all up, moving stuff around. And the only thing that bothers me that I cannot remember why or how or whatever is that how all the tempos kind of matched, you know, and he might have altered some of that to make it work, but we never cut that song in the studio as you hear it. We didn't cut that top to bottom the way it is.
So that make it a challenge to play live afterwards? Because no, now you're playing another monster.
We've been playing it live. We played it live, you know, a few days ago. You learn it once you hear it, then you learn it like that.
That's so cool.
There's nothing so demanding on the song that you can't play it live. It's not like one of those things where you edit yourself into a corner and you can't play it live, you know. But I mean, we didn't have that concept going in. We had these four licks and we developed them to where they sound just like they do on the record. But it wasn't a complete song till Bill got his hands on it.
I'm curious. Yeah. Does that create a little bit of frustration if you're working on an album, you got four songs, then all of a sudden, oh, great, now we got one song, we have to go find three more songs.
Well, yeah, but, you know, Joe always would have, he'd like 30, 40 ideas he'd bring to the studio, not that any of them were complete, just little riffs and stuff. So we had plenty of material, but yeah, that's a good point.
Well, also, you know, speaking of stories, I do want to bring up again, bring up for everybody that you have a book out, Backstage Pass, Stories from the Road and in the Studio with Crosby, Stills and Nash, Dan Fogelberg, Peter Frampton, the Eagles, Ted Nugent, Joe Walsh, Neil Young, and many more. What's the best way people get this off your website?
Yeah, joevitaliondrums.com.
There you go. So
we send them out signed and we throw in CDs with them. It's a good deal. It's the best deal.
Can you share one story from that book as a teaser?
We were touring with the Eagles. I was out with the Eagles and from the Long Run album, because I did the Long Run tour, and on the Long Run, they had a song called Those Shoes. I don't know if you know that song or not.
Yeah.
Anyway, and it's like da-da, da-da,
yeah.
Right? Okay. That's it. And so in the middle of it, Don Felder and Joe Walsh had a dual talk box solo going. It's killer. They were burning it. It was great. And one night, I don't know, I was just, you know, those guys are pretty funny about sticking to the arrangement of the records and all that, you know, and I was aware of that. But these two guys were doing their talk box leads and they were just so badass that I at the end of the solo, going back into the song, I put a funky fill, you know, going in because nobody thought, you know, somebody turned around and said, yeah, cool. You know, it was no big deal. But later that night and Don Henley never called me in my room or anything. He called me and he said, hey, he used to call me Joe Bob, a Texas thing, right? Joe Bob. I think it was because when he yelled Joe, me and Walsh would go, what? You know, he had to decipher who I was.
So
he called
me Joe Bob. Joe, you are, yeah.
Right. So I picked up the phone and it's like, hey, Joe Bob, it's Henley. Come up to my room. I went, okay. He never did that, you know. So I go up to his room and I'll never forget it. He opens the door. It's like a Ritz-Carlton hotel or something. He opens the door and the chain's still on the door, you know, and talking through the door. He's got his robe on and he says, hey, yeah, you know that Phil coming out of the talk box solos? And I thought he was going to give me a compliment here. He looks at me like this. He goes, don't do that. and then he goes, have a nice night, and he shuts the door. I'm like crushed, right? Wow. And so I'm like, oh man, I don't want to blow this gig, you know, so I'll never do that again. So that's half the story. The next day we got some other next show, some other city, and we're at sound check in the afternoon, and so Glenn Frey comes over to me. And he goes, hey, Joe Bob, he says, you know that drum fill? I'm like, okay, here we go again, right? And he pulls a couple of hundreds. He says, play it again. I said, no way am I playing.
We need to have a meeting.
Yeah, we're going to have a band meeting for that. You know?
Right.
I said, Glenn, there's not enough zeros on those bills for me to play that drum fill again. I don't feel like getting fired. Anyway.
You didn't want to get the Don Henley look again.
Oh man, I love Don. Those guys are so great. They were fun to work with. It was challenging at times because you know, they play stuff like the record. You know, people pay a lot of money to see them, and when you see them live, they're so good live, and so they don't like to drift off the arrangements or do different things. They want to sound like the records and all that. And unlike Joe, when we play with Joe's solo stuff, we jam. You know, it gets loose and
like Rocky Mountain Way kind of thing.
Yeah, we stretch out a little bit and have fun, you know, and people like that too, you know, so it's just two different styles, you know, but yeah. Anyway, needless to say, I never played that fill again.
So you were on the Long Run tour, so you got to witness some of the backstage drama. Was there ever, I mean, did you feel like you had to just try to stay as neutral as possible? Because you worked with Don Felder over the years as well. Or was it, there was never any pressure to say, okay, your team Don or your team Don Felder? Or
well, no, because. There was a little friction between Glenn and Don, but not just common band for, you know, once in a while there was a little riff, you know, nothing major. But what went on that night is what blew it out of proportion. It was got crazy. And I'm a utility guy because I played keys, I played drums, I sang a little, whatever I did, I just a utility guy, right? So I wasn't, I was just a hired hand, you know, hired gun to do what I did. And so I wasn't that involved with any like the big meetings and all that stuff. I just was a road guy. And documentary about the Eagles, the way Glenn Frey explains what happened that night, I was 2 feet from all that. And the way he explained it is exactly what happened.
Wow.
It was spot on. What he said was exactly what happened. And it was pretty ugly. And that night on stage, after Glenn introduced everybody, he fired everybody. he said, say hello to our bass player, Timothy B. Schmidt, and say goodbye. You know? Fired everybody. And he off mic, right? He would say hello to our lead guitar player, Joe Walsh. And off mic, he'd go, and say goodbye. And so he fired everybody. It had reached a boiling point. And you know, I'm glad they got back. It was, you know, it needed to maybe take a break. I don't know. I didn't think it was going to take 14 years break, but.
Till hell freeze over.
Till hell's freeze over. Yeah. But anyway, they're back at it and they're doing their farewell tour now.
Yeah.
Well, that and many more. Those stories are in Backstage Pass. So if that doesn't make you want to go get the book, I don't know what will. I mean, there's so many other stories in there to get. And
well, you are part of history. I mean, do you have like a real sense of your own gravity of you were there for the Kent State event? You've worked with incredible guitarists. I mean, even, you know, Phil Keaggy and Rick Derringer, of course, everybody with the Eagles, Crosby, Stills and Nash. I mean, so do you have the sense of the, you know, you're part of history in a lot of different ways.
Well, I guess I am. I don't look at it as it's like that. I guess I just look at it as you know, each year had a new challenge, a new band, new personality, you know, and I felt very blessed that I could. What happens in rock and roll is, you know, if one guy uses you and you make a record and it becomes a hit, then another guy wants to use you, you know. And there's no magic formula. If there was, everybody would have a hit, you know. But they kind of associate hits with the people who made them. And I was one of the musicians on a lot of those hits. And so people then would reach out to me to play on their, you know, album, whatever. And so I guess through all the years, as years go by, because it becomes history, whether good or bad history, but it becomes history. And I look back and I'm very thankful for the opportunities I've had, mainly because musically I got to play with so many different people from different walks of life and different styles. And And I learned so much from each one of them, and because they're all different, you know, and they all write different, they all record different, they all have a different sense of live playing, the way they want to, you know, like Neil Young, when we recorded those records with Neil Young, he never ever overdubbed his vocal. It was always live. He had a mic and his guitar, and he'd play, and we'd track, and he'd sing it live. And the engineer, the producer would always say, "Hey, Neil, you know, you can go in the booth. You can overdub your vocal." I mean, nope. He said, "If I can't do this live in a studio, you know, while the band's playing, that doesn't guarantee me that I can do it live if I overdub." Well, I understood what he meant, because a lot of times people cut songs, cut records, they cut vocals or guitars, or whatever they do. And all of a sudden, they get to the stage and they can't do it. They can't perform it. And he has never had that problem, because he performed it live in the studio like he would on stage. And I just think that's scary. It's a challenge. It's dangerous. But he's so good at it that he was just felt natural about it. When we cut that song, "Long May You Run," from the Stills Young Band, right? And we weren't even quite ready. I used to smoke cigarettes many years ago, and I had a cigarette and I had one stick in my hand, and it was like, "Long may you run." I was just playing on the hat and all that. He's singing, the band's playing. I thought we were warming up. We were rehearsing it, right? And then I put the cigarette down, pick up my other stick, and I'm playing, right? And nobody thought. And when we're done, Neil said, "Great, that's it." And I go, "Wait a minute." I said, "I was just," and one guy wasn't even playing. It's like, "But that's," he said, "that felt great." And it really does feel good, the song, you know, it came out great. And so he's very loose like that, but he's not loose in a sense of what he chooses as the master and all that, you know. He's very selective and all that, but he's very loose about stuff like that. If it feels good, that's the record. You know, and that's, he's right. Because that's what, when people listen to that, it'll feel good to them too. If it felt good to us, you know, it'll feel good to them. And, you know, there's a little mistakes on that. You can clean up, you can fix those, you know. We've made so many records that the second or third take, you know, it was actually better, mechanically better. Nobody made a mistake. And nobody was out of tune, and every lick was perfect and all that. And the producer would go, "Nope, I'm taking take one, because this one sounds like you knew it too well. It's not, doesn't have any magic." But so I understood totally when Neil did that. And actually, to make records like that, that's like the old days. That's the way they used to make them in the 50s. They didn't overdub anything. They was all played and sung at once, you know. But what was really cool for us musicians is that when we're playing a song, especially a new song, when we're hearing the music and the vocal all at the same time, it's a roadmap. You know where you are, you know the energy of the, you know, and instead of trying to imagine, all right, the chorus is coming up, and, you know, we were hearing it as it was going down. So I really like recording with Neil. He's great to record with.
He's another one that it looks like he's been able to dictate his career the way that he's wanted to, whether the labels were happy with it or not, but he's been very
right.
Yeah. You
know, I don't think the labels even tried to tell him what to do.
Really?
No, he's stubborn like that, but that's good. I appreciate that. You know, he's like, nah, they didn't tell him what to do.
Well, the other three, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that had to be something, being in rooms so they were doing their harmonies together, because, you know, we're big harmony guys, and I'll tell you, those harmonies are nothing like you ever heard when those three would get together with their voices.
Their magic was amazing. They would stand around one mic, and the three of them would sing at once. And instead of, you know, on the verses, each guy sings their part on the separate tracks and all that, you know. Steven insisted that they all sing at once, because you can hear, you blend as you go. You can hear the blend. And then all the engineer would do would say, you know, David, move back 2 inches or Graham, I need you a little further in. And then the engineer assistant would come out with white tape and put it on the floor. And that's where the front of your shoes go. That's your position, because that was the balance. It was a physical balance to the microphone. You know, instead of faders, you had to be closer to the mic or further away. And you'd hear that blend. And it was like, it was unbelievable, the blend they had. Then they would like double it, or, you know, and it was like this thick, beautiful sound. And it was different than when you had Crosby on this fader and Nash on this fader and Steven on this fader, right? And you try to blend that like that. It's not the same. I read that that's exactly what the Beach Boys did their
vocals. I was just going to say that. Yep.
Yeah. When they did theirs, now they didn't have 24 tracks and all that, so they were kind of had to, but that's what they did.
Yep.
They all stood around a microphone. There's video of them doing that. They stood around a microphone, and whether Brian was singing along or in the control room, they would find the blend. And it was, it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
That's a beautiful tie. Oh, go. Sorry.
I was just going to say, when I was doing a lot of posts earlier this year on Little River Band and talking with their members, Graham Goble, and he had said the same thing, like in reminiscing, you got to get around the mic, all of them together. And that's when you really feel it.
Yeah. Some of the big, big choruses on CSN, they would triple track, only because triple tracking would mean there's only three tracks. It's not like six or eight. I mean, so, you know, 2-4-6, then 2-4, you know, and all these tracks. If they would just stand around the mic and sing it, because they used to have a left and a right, and they would bring it, they would tease the center one just a little bit, just to thicken it a little bit. And it was a beautiful mix, because the full left and right would sound full left and right. It wouldn't be right. And as soon as you brought that center one in there, mono, it just pulled them all together. And so, and I remember many times that the vocals were just great, but maybe we had a little too much of Crosby, right? So the third track, they'd say, Crosby, back up 6 inches. And that fixed the whole mix. I mean, it was very, very, you know, it was old school for days. You know, it was really old school. And, and there was no auto-tune, and there was no, let's do 20 takes and I'll comp a vocal. You know, one time we did a song in the studio. I can't remember the song. It might have been Turn to Stone or something we did with Joe Walsh. Anyway, and Joe just killed this solo. He just, what a Joe Walsh solo. It was beautiful. And Joe comes in and we're like, yeah, man, great. And he goes, nah, he says, I think I can do better. And we're like, no, it's great. Don't touch it. And he goes, no, I want to do another one. I know I can beat it. And the problem is, back in the day, is we're out of tracks, you know? So the only way he could beat that is if we burn the one he did. Right. And so Simzik said, I'm not pushing that red button, because I love that solo. That, you know, Bill, not, you know, being a great producer, he already took that solo track and he offloaded it onto a T-track. He wasn't going to press the red button. You know, then, remember, there was no undo.
Yeah.
It was done. If you hit the red button, that's it, gone. Right. So he would save it over to it. But so he said, I'm not pushing the red button. And he was actually pissed. He was not happy, because, and Joe insisted, he said, I could beat it. So he said, Vitaly, you push the button. I said, oh, man, don't make me do it.
Oh, man.
And Walsh said, no, push the button. I went, okay, but you said to do it. Okay. So I hit record. He killed his song. He beat it. It was even better. So he really gave the finger to all of us.
Joe's a big personality. Do you feel, does he just like pull people into his universe?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No. You become Team Walsh when no matter what, except that he wouldn't pull me in. I would not take a chainsaw to a hotel room. No, he used to goof on the hotel. You know, he's got an anvil case that is in the shape. It's a chainsaw. It's a case of chainsaw. And if you look at the anvil case, it, you know, like when you look at a saxophone case, you can see that it's a saxophone, mm-hmm. right? The case, right? The outline. This is a, you can see that it's a chainsaw. And he used to goof on hotels because whether there was a chainsaw in the thing or not, to check in at the front desk, he would be carrying this thing. He already had this reputation of what, you know, and so the hotel people got nervous, you know.
Yeah.
There's never a dull moment, you know?
Yeah. I got insurance to pay for it all.
Yeah. When he does in Life's Been Good, they write me letters, right?
Tell me I'm great.
Now he sings, they send me emails, tell me I'm great.
I've got a question here. Kenton, first off, I've got a viewer, Kenton, saying he's got incredible respect for you. And he wanted to ask about Fogelberg. He's probably like me. I love Dan Fogelberg.
Yeah, that was one of my questions too.
Yeah, so having the opportunity to work with Dan Fogelberg, he'd like to hear some of that.
Oh, Danny, oh, God bless him. I miss him so much. What an artist. We met Dan Fogelberg when we first started Barnstorm, 1972. And our manager and Fogelberg were from the same Champaign or Peoria, Illinois, one of the Champaign, Illinois, maybe. Anyway, and so our manager, Irv Azoff, he wanted Joe Walsh to produce Dan's first record, which he did. But and so when we were on tour with Joe, our manager asked if Dan could ride along with us, right? And we were in a station wagon back then. We couldn't afford any other travel, so we had a station wagon. So Danny rode with us. We didn't know who he was. Nice young kid, you know, long hair. And so he brought his little cassette with him, right? And he was going to, during the drives, he was going to play Joe the material, and because Joe was going to produce it. And so he puts the cassette on. We're like, whoa, who is this? This, the vocal was like, what is this music? This is fantastic. And so, and it was just his little demo tape that he made right at home or something. And so he became part of the whole Walsh Eagles family. He was, you know, and a lot of us worked with Dan. We recorded with him, and we did tours with him. And I'll never forget, every night on tour, he did Leader of the Band. And that's the song about his dad. And if it was about my dad and I couldn't get through it, I'd fall apart before getting to it. He sang it every night, and he sang it like, it was totally emotional for him, but he sang it with complete respect and honor to his dad, you know. And it was just amazing how he could, I don't know how anybody could get through that song if it was about their dad and singing that song. Anyway, but Dan was so awesome to work for. He had this beautiful place in the middle of the mountains above Pagosa Springs, Colorado. And he skied, he had horses, he was a cowboy, you know, and he was a great guy. And and every once in a while I would get a call, and he said, hey, and he'd call me Joe Bob too because of Henley, and he said, hey Henley, I mean, hey Joe Bob, you able to do some touring? And I said, yeah, of course. And his tours were always incredible, and the band was always incredible. He sold out everywhere. And he was just such a respected artist. And I can't even imagine. I don't ever remember he had a bad night. He was always really good. And that's you can't say that about every artist. They had their bad nights. This guy was amazing. And we all miss him. And he buried himself up in that mountain house. He had this beautiful, beautiful home up in the mountains. And when he'd get done with touring, he would go to that, his home, and he wouldn't leave for 2 months. He just hung out up there. And, unfortunately he didn't get to the doctor enough, and they discovered cancer, and he succumbed to the, you know, cancer. And he was like, what, 50 or something?
He's young.
something like that.
That and, one hurts. I miss him. I didn't know him.
You know why? Because he wasn't done yet. He had plenty of music, and he was so funny and so great, and such a family. He was in the family, you know, the family being, you know, all the people that Irving managed, and it was kind of one big happy family, and he was certainly in that family. You know, Jimmy Buffett was in that family, and we just lost Jimmy. And so, yeah, that one was really hurt because he was so young, and he was nowhere near like retired or done yet, anything like that. You know, he had plenty of music left in him. And he was just, we used to rehearse up at his place. And the whole experience was fantastic. And I really miss him because those tours we did and those recordings we did were really special. He was so good at it and so relaxed and just so confident in what he did. And every night he was just incredible. And he packed places. He sold out everywhere he went. People loved him, you know.
Did he do a lot of the material from Netherlands? Netherlands on his solo, on his performances, his live performances?
A bunch of it, yes. Yeah, a bunch of it. We did a lot from The Innocent Age, because that had some hits on it. And but he had a huge catalog.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, whatever the current record was out, we did a bunch of that, you know. But he always did the hits, you know, and part of the plan and all the going way back and everything. But we did something from every one of his albums. He would do a couple of cuts from each album.
Wow,
that's amazing. Yeah, like you were on listening to you, like I was listening today on Loose Ends.
Oh, that's a great song.
Well, and you did the drums on that track, right, Joe?
Yeah.
There was a moment at like 3:07 of that song. I made notes for that. It's just beautiful the way you lay down your parts along with Dan. Just beautiful.
Well, he was one of them artists that.
Uh-oh.
Made sure everybody was comfortable with the arrangement and to get comfortable with it before we'd even push the red button, you know, and, he'd iron out some things, leaving plenty of room for the magic. That's was really cool. We learned it to a point where he did not want to go past missing that magic when you get your take, you know, your master take. And he's just a brilliant artist. Every aspect of being an artist, he was an ace at, you know.
Can I ask you too? I notice you do a lot of shows or parts with your son. Was he just like a shadow around, like when you were playing? Did he just want to be a part of the music with you? Because he's such a musician himself.
He's great. When he was about 9 or 10, my wife brought him to, we played locally a Crosby, Stills, Nash a concert in Cleveland, I think. And they used to come to a lot of the shows, especially local. And Graham Nash asked, my son was already taking drum lessons even at 9. Right. But so Graham asked him to come up and play tambourine on Teach Your Children. Right. Oh, and wow. Which ruined his life. And so once did that and he looked out and there were like thousands of people like, yay, that was it. He was finished. You know? that's what happened to me when I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I said, oh, that's what I'm doing. My father that was sitting there, not very happy, said, you're not doing that. You're going to college and you're going to get, I said, no, I'm doing that. And so, but anyway, so my son, he got a really cool bird's eye education of rock and roll and touring and what it was all about. And he saw the good and he saw the bad. You know, he saw what happens when certain people on the road drank too much or He learned, you know, that's not good to do, Dad, is it? No, that's not good to do.
No.
So he had a great education, and he learned a lot of things that had nothing to do with music. He learned a lot of stuff about, you know, you got to get your rest, and you got to, you know, you can't be tired. You know, you're going to lose your voice if you stay up all night, and you can't do this, that, yeah. And he learned a lot of stuff that on his own that I really didn't teach him. He just, you know, he could see it that, you know, oh, he said, Dad, why is he? I said, well, you know, you can't stay up all night drinking. Not good. So now he learned stuff that a lot of people, you don't learn in school. He learned stuff by seeing and witnessing and experiencing, and that stuck with him. And he's a solid person now, and he's getting really, really good at what he does. And he's got his own band. He does a lot of solo acoustic guitar, solo stuff. You know, he started with drums, but he noticed that the guitar player singers were getting all the attention. So he moved to the front of the stage. Me, I'm happy to be back there. You know,
that's funny.
With technology, the rise, AI, et cetera. I mean, technology is a tool. Obviously, there's a lot of benefits that can come with it. But I'd be curious from your opinion, do you feel it's also becoming a crutch and maybe making things too easy to the point where that organic experience of stress, trauma, et cetera, tension that creates the art that we're shortcutting that? And
you nailed it. Just like I was saying about Joe Walsh wanting to replace his guitar solo. You know, it took balls to do that. I got to tell you, it took a lot of guts, and you had to really be confident. Nowadays, you know, you got, you know, well, you want to do 50 more solo. No challenge, and there's no moment of winning. Or engineer, or whatever, and they put it all together and make a solo, and it's mechanically correct, but it doesn't come from the soul of the heart. Like when you start a solo from the top to the bottom, it evolves through the each measure of this. It builds, and there's a story to be told there, and you can't take a bunch of pieces and make a solo and it be the same thing. It's mechanically correct and sounds good, but there's nothing like a solo top to bottom when you start a solo and you have so many measures and you got to get to the end, and it's got to peak and it's got to say, you got to say something. And so in the old days, like I said, there was no undo. So we went for it, you know, and I think it's okay with what you do today. It's okay. But I would prefer, even in today's technology, if we're in a studio with a, you know, Pro Tools studio and a guy's out there going to take a solo, I would love it if you just played the solo top to bottom and with no comping, no cutting it up and all that. Just jam and have a good time. And because as soon as you start doing that, you lose the magic, I think. And so we were forced to do that because we couldn't just, we didn't have enough tracks to do what everybody does today. And some of that is okay today, because I do think it's really cool to have a lot of tracks to experiment with, to try things and then go, okay, let's start. Now I know what to do, because you tried a whole bunch of stuff. And you listen to it and lived with it, and you go, okay, let's get rid of all that, and now I know what to do. But it's a hard thing to think about when I think that, yeah, it's really good on some things, and technology today, it's really good. I think the editing is great, but I don't, you know, auto-tune, eh. You know, yeah. I've heard too many great singers that just sing and it's beautiful. And if they slur a note a little, just a little flat or something, they meant to do that. And you can feel that it's meant to do. Or if someone's screaming and it goes a little sharp, you know, you feel that, you know.
Yeah.
Have the same feeling, you know. And it's really there's a very fine line between magic and creativity and technology. It's a very razor thin line between, and it's hard to cross over sometimes, but I think that technology today is good. I really respect artists that have an old school sense, and they use the new technology to the best of they can with old school sense.
One of the followers on TikTok, that one dude nobody follows, which I love his handle, said pieces are for puzzles, not music.
Right.
Well put, sir. And that's true. It's very true, you know. And I've sat and watched Stephen Stills do solos top to bottom, Joe Walsh, Neil, whoever, Glenn Felder, what. And they just, you know, it doesn't matter if you go through like solos, you need 10 takes or something. You do it in 10 times each. And I'll give me one more time. And the point is, when you finally get the solo, it's top to bottom. You played it. You didn't put that together, you know. And I know that somebody's going to say to me, well, you're just old fashioned. No, I'm not. It's called magic and music and creativity. And I've seen too many players just kill a solo, a beautiful solo they played. And it's a statement instead of segments of it's a complete sentence instead of just words, you know? So I don't know. I'll argue that point. People my age would agree with me. Young people go, that's why would you do that?
Yeah.
I'm surprised to see how many movies and TV shows you've been involved with. Is there any that stand out to you? Like,
the TV has always been pretty much the same. We did a whole bunch of those, you know, late night shows, and they were always kind of the same, you know, pretty decent production on them. And, you know, the crew, the sound crew, and were always really, you know, very good and excellent crews and all that. But the movie I did a movie with Meryl Streep. And I was the drummer in the movie, thank God, because I didn't have to act like anybody. I'm not an actor. And so that was so interesting to me, because when you have a movie with Meryl Streep, it's like, you know, it's top notch. It's like that's everything is, you know, the best with, you know, because it's her movie. And so I got to witness what that world was like. And that is it's a tough world, man. We were doing 10, 12 hours a day. The crew were doing 18 hours a day, and take after take after take. But, you know, I watched Meryl Streep do like 12 takes of this scene. And I'm not in the actor's world and all that, but any one of those takes, if I was the director, I would say that was fantastic. But yeah. I'm not a director, but no, what I'm saying is, she did take after take, which to me, any one of them would have been incredible, right? And except the director saw something that he, you know. So I learned a lot about that world, and I'm glad I'm a musician and not an actor, because that's a tough world. That's tough. Those people are so talented. She, Meryl, it was a rock and roll movie. She was in a band. She was a guitar player, singer in a club band. That's what the movie was. It's called Ricky and the Flash. And she, before she, each day, she had her laptop off stage and offset, and she was studying like Madonna and Pink and all these artists and watching what they do live. And she was doing mimicking the moves. And she's so involved and into it that you watching her work was really amazing experience, you know? So I just had to be, Rick Springfield was in the movie too. But I just had to be a drummer, and I didn't even have to be called by a different name. My name was Joe Sweeney.
There you go. Meryl couldn't get it wrong.
I didn't have to even try to get used to somebody saying, "Hey, Brian," and I go, "What?" You know.
Wasn't Joe Bob?
No,
I was in a movie with Meryl Streep. You see that? Joe, wow, look how fast an hour can go. joke.
Wow, we can talk some more if you want.
Well, we could. We'd love to have you back because there's more things I'd love to cover with you. But I just appreciate you taking time out of your life, Dean. Thanks for setting this up with Joe. This was awesome. I would
definitely love to get you back and keep the conversation going.
Oh, there's a lot to talk about. Yeah. We'll do this again. There's a whole interesting session we did with John Lennon that it is really.
That's what I was going to ask you too. Yeah, we'll get into that.
Well, we'll do that another time because there's a half hour right there.
Well, I definitely want to read the book. So we'll have to get back. Let me read the book and then we'll get back.
Yeah.
Send me addresses. Send me addresses.
Okay.
We got homework.
Yeah, we got homework to do. Everyone go buy Backstage Pass from Joe Vitale. Go get it. It's out. Go to his website. Joe Vitale on drums. Is that what it was? Your website?
Yeah, joevitaleondrums.com.
.com. Go get the book. And then we'll all do it together. It's like a, what do they call that thing? Where you get together, book club.
SFM 2.0 book club.
2.0 book club. And then when we get Joe back, we'll all read to him like we were in the book club.
So there you go. Well, that's story time. Story time.
There you go.
Thank you, Joe Vitale. Thanks for having you, man.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks,
guys. Pleasure.
We'll talk to you here very soon.
All right. Thank you.